This is an interview for the McKeldin Jackson Project of the Maryland Historical Society with Mr. Louis Shubb on January the 12th, 1976 at Goucher College. The interviewer is Ellen Paul. Now, were you involved at all in any organizational activities at this, during the period, say, from 1945 on?
Until the
1965 year, approximately, when the Black Panther movement started and the violence movement
started. What you were concerned with, that you don't want to know anything about my political movement?
Well, Dr. Jackson, for example, was president of the NAACP. Now, I'm curious to know what kind of organizational affiliations you had at that time in the civil rights movement.
The only one I can think of, we were both members of NAACP, or we weren't active in NAACP around that time. We just paid our dues and so forth. You said in the beginning you didn't want to know anything about my political activities. What does that mean?
Well,
you mean like running for office or something like that? You mean that kind of political
activity? Well, I'd certainly like to know.
Because civil rights is a political activity.
I certainly would like to know any of the events that you yourself participated in.
Rather important one. It didn't have to do with directly with black and white relations. Or you're not interested in
that's fine.
In the 1950s, the legislature during the McCarthy era passed a law known as the Ober Law. Ober was the legislature. Which all state employees were required to sign a loyalty oath. Also, it had other provisions. I mean, seeking out grads who were ready to overturn the government in Annapolis or elsewhere. And there was a citizens' committee formed to push for a referendum on this law. And I was active in that citizens committee, and eventually I was the chairman of that citizens committee against the Ober Law. And we got the necessary signatures for the Ober Law, for the referendum rather, to provide a vote against the Ober Law. And to put it on the ballot, so if the citizens of Maryland would either approve of the Ober Law or disapprove. However, it turned out that the vote was still to maintain the Ober Law. But we pushed it through in the courts in Maryland, and the first decision rendered down by Judge was a rather well-known judge from Baltimore. So, I'll remember his name later. Anyway, his decision was that the Ober Law was unconstitutional. But the decision was appealed later on, and I can't remember exactly what happened, but the Ober Law remained on the books. Remained on the books until very, very recently. So everybody, even garbage collectors, and in addition to school teachers and so forth, had to sign this loyalty oath in order to either get employment or maintain their employment. So anyway, I was active in that, and that was the extent, I recall, of my political activities in that regard around that time. You know, you'll have to ask me some questions.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure you were through. At the time of, say, the 1950 civil rights movement, especially around the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954, demanding integration of the schools.
Yeah.
What kind of reaction did people have, either in the suburbs or in the city, to these kind of movements?
You mean here in Baltimore, as opposed
right.
to, say, Alabama or
exactly.
Mississippi? I'm trying to remember. I can't remember any specific cases. My impression, you know, was that people accepted it more and waited to see what the implementation of the law really meant. Because most people in this country, anyway, anything that's handed down by the government is accepted as the word of God. And they generally tended first to accept anything that's handed down by a high tribunal like the Supreme Court is something that they have to obey. I think that was it. I certainly don't remember any active, very active movements here in Baltimore, in Maryland, against that 1954 decision.
Do you feel that people's expectations at the time of what this law would include and how large the impact would be was lesser than what we would expect today of an integration law? For example, might have expected that it wouldn't touch their personal lives at that time.
I can't speak for most people. I do know that the blacks expected much more out of this 1954 decision. I hate to be in the position of a white liberal who decides to say what blacks think or not, but obviously they expected by this time certainly to have that decision implemented in a much more meaningful way than it has been. About the whites, my impression was that there was no uproar the way there was in the way there was recently in, or there is recently in Boston, for example, against busing. At least that was my impression. My memory of it is rather hazy. I'm not quite sure.
Did people in the suburbs have any direct participation in any of the civil rights movements? For example, when something like this happened, when this law was passed, did many people begin to pull their children out of schools or move further out into the suburbs or move from the city across city lines into the suburbs? Was that very noticeable in this area?
I don't think so. In the first place, there was a, in general, the movement to the suburbs wasn't as massive as it has been recently. No, as I recall, in the first place, the implementation of the 1954 decision wasn't a dramatic one. It happened very, very gradually. As far as I can remember, black schools still remain black schools and white schools still remain white schools, mainly because the neighborhoods were far from integrated. And I think that's what happened. What happened was that if there were a few black kids living within the area of the school, then they came into the classroom and conclusion of several blacks didn't make the whites move out en masse. It certainly wasn't the school decision that made them move. I think it was the housing pattern that panicked a lot of them.
Did anyone have the reaction at that time that what was being accomplished was not true integration, or certainly not full integration?
I think blacks and liberals hoped that it would lead to full integration. If I recall, the 1954 decision meant at that time, 1954, this was a decision, and most people sat back and said, well, let's see how this will work out. I think that was the general feeling. It depended on what part of the political spectrum you were allied with.
So there must have been some dissatisfaction with the results.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
On both sides.
Yeah.
Let's go to Dr. Lily Mae Jackson. You said that you knew Dr. Jackson.
I had met her. I didn't really know her. I knew what she was doing. And one of the first examples of the work she did and the NAACP did in civil rights, one of the first dramatic ones, was a continuous picket line around the now defunct Ford Theater. Blacks were not allowed to sit anywhere but way up in the last balcony at that time. And that picket line lasted for a long time. Tremendous. I never walked that picket line. I think that my wife did on occasion. There was a small picket line every night for as long as the theater was in operation. And it seemed as if the thing was going to be a failure. Of course, there was no way activity on the part of the management of Ford's Theater to give in, and if the show was good, they had pretty good audiences. It did seem to affect the theater, but eventually, evidently it did. That plus other things helped break down the segregation in the theater. Another activity that that we were aware of, whether we actively engaged in it, I can't remember. It was the segregation in park facilities, which is tennis courts. In Jude Hill Park, which is even then on a boundary line, or the sort of a Mason-Dixon line between black and white areas. Blacks couldn't play on the so-called white tennis courts. They had a few scrubby tennis courts off in another part of the park. And there was nothing to own to there. They were never kept in any kind of condition. And a number of people decided to test this prohibition against blacks. Each white took a black partner and started to play tennis there. They got a permit. The whites got a permit to play. And the police ordered them off the tennis courts. And they refused to go. And they were actually carried into the... few of them were carried into the paddy wagon. And given that what happened at that particular event, I can't recall if they were fined or what. I think they were fined and given probation. In other words, they were found guilty of violating the law. But I think it's one of the things that eventually helped to break down segregation in the parks. You have to remember that Baltimore was and I guess it was a southern city in sentiment. That distinction no longer holds, I guess, anymore, because Boston now is a southern city of sentiment also. But in those days, there was a definite difference between the feeling in a city like Baltimore and a city in some of the northern cities. The northern cities were considered more liberal towards the blacks.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What kind of method or effect would you say that Dr. Jackson had on people that she was speaking to? She began her career as a religious singer and
yeah.
a speaker. Did she can have that type of effect on people?
Oh, yes. She was a very powerful personality. When she spoke, it was really, she was very eloquent, extremely so. You don't have any tapes some must exist because you had to hear her to realize what a personality she was. It was really, she had this combination of a political leader and a gospel preacher, and she moved audiences. There's no question about it. Not only the black singing audience, but the whites and whites also. So her very personality had a big effect on the civil rights movement in Baltimore.
Do you think that she was very effective in changing the opinion makers' opinions and the policy makers' opinions? In other words, the people who were in official government positions or positions of power in the city. Do you think she really had an effect on them, or was her primary effect on the people that would be affected by any law?
No, it's pretty hard to measure what effect she had. Certainly she had an effect. In the first place, she also NAACP were involved in getting more blacks to register to vote. And when she came with, a number of votes behind her, I think that was a definite effect on the political leaders in Baltimore and Maryland. I'm sure. Without her, I think it would have been even slower. But there's no way. How do you gauge such a thing? I don't know. Unless you were in the city council, unless you were in the legislature, and you saw how the votes went after she spoke, you just have to acknowledge that.
You mentioned that in some cases, such as the Park incident, there were encounters with the police. So what do you attribute the fact that there were no violent encounters as we've come to know them in the late 60s?
I don't know. I think the whole movement, I think it was because of the, I can only guess, it was because of the hope that blacks and liberals had that the change would be effected through the courts, the way the 1954 decision to us meant that this was a landmark and this things were going to move ahead. And when they didn't, I think frustration helped spark a more violent approach. I don't know how widespread this violent approach was. Recent revelations showed that there were lots of people who were infiltrated in some of these organizations who sparked, instigated some of these violent incidents in order to cripple the civil rights movement. Again, I don't have any real evidence, but we know such things did happen. So I think it was a combination of both. I think there were sincere people who thought that a violent approach would do something that the orderly approach didn't accomplish, and also many others who became sort of agent provocateurs in order to arouse people against the civil rights movement.
Just how would you place Baltimore in a spectrum of civil rights movements? You know, as for example, you said now that we know Boston is pretty much a southern city. How would you rank Baltimore in that kind of spectrum. Do you feel that resistance here was particularly great, or that the change came pretty much along the lines of the national movement?
I have no way of knowing. I know that the civil rights movement in Baltimore was pretty strong.
But this is basically Baltimore City.
Yeah, Baltimore City. Outside of Baltimore, in Maryland, I don't remember any of the particular activity. I think it was mainly in Baltimore. I think it was true of all over the country at that time, but in the larger cities, the larger the city, the greater the movement. But you have to remember that being involved in a civil rights movement in many cases, when you didn't have support of a substantial number of people with you, as you would, for instance, if you tried something in a small town in Maryland, you'd be immediately ostracized. You'd lose your job. If you were at any kind of business, you'd lose your business. All these things, that had a definite effect. In Baltimore, it was a little easier in a way, because you did have organizations like NAACP behind you, and other civil rights organizations that were active in a larger city than where they weren't active in a small town.
So that Southern Maryland or the Eastern Shore, perhaps Evans, changed a little bit slower than the city did.
I would say the change didn't occur at all for many years, except certainly not through the state lawmakers, but the state politicians, the federal, I think, felt that they had to have implemented this issue, at least made a token implementation of the 1954 decision. The Eastern Shore was very much like the Deep South was, as I recall.
The movement in the city of Baltimore had definitely then some effect from people such as Dr. Jackson. Do you feel that when the movement lost leaders like this, it simply floundered and had no direction, or do you feel that it's an ongoing movement still?
I'm not sure I really know. In Baltimore, you certainly don't have personality like Lily Jackson, but you have a number of other people. Black leaders who have quite a following, who are very vocal and are very strong leaders. What direction they take, I'm not quite sure. For instance, Harry Mitchell and the whole Mitchell family, who of course were related to Lily Jackson, still carry on that sort of thing, and as a matter of fact, Harry Mitchell is in a position where he's even a stronger position to influence things than Lily Jackson was. Lily Jackson wasn't a member of any lawmaking body the way Harry Mitchell was, and the other members of the Harry Mitchell family, like Clarence Mitchell, was nephew of Harry Mitchell. Well, they're there, and what we have now are blacks who are in the legislature, who are in Congress. That makes a big difference. Before that, I remember coming back to earlier days, who were involved in a campaign to elect a black member to the Maryland legislature. His name was Cole, C-O-L-E. And he ran against, as a matter of fact, he ran against a man named Marvin Mandel, who was now governor. And he beat him, even though Mandel at that time had powerful political backing from Jack Pollock, who's one of the big political leaders, or was then, in Northwest Baltimore. As a matter of fact, he was considered the most powerful political boss in Baltimore, and Cole was elected. He was one of the first to blacks to be in those times to be elected to the lawmaking body. And after that, of course, there were many others, naturally. So your original question was, are there any people who can compare with Willie Jackson? Well, I think there still are.
And now it's in a more official, more efficacious
way. That's right, yeah,
way.
That's right, yeah. It's not a matter of just the personality.
Down in areas, traditional blue-collar working areas of Baltimore City, was there any hostility to this kind of movement, especially as far as job action was concerned?
I don't know about that. I know that in areas such as Woodbury and Camden, these pockets of they always remain pockets of resistance to any kind of integration. I don't know how it is now, but back in those days, definitely. And I remember canvassing against the Oberlaw in those areas. It was much more difficult than in the other area of Baltimore. That didn't have anything to do with directly with black and white relationships, but they were always much more conservative or reactionary, whichever term you want to use, than almost any other part of Baltimore.
I think you can safely state that there's still a good deal of work to be done. Do you think, or would you like to see, a civil rights movement of the nature led by Dr. William A. Jackson reinstituted in Baltimore? Do you think that would have any effect? In other words, what kind of future do you see for furthering civil rights in this area?
Well, I always thought that the 1954 decision was only a part of there was only one decision that would make only part of a real integration equality movement possible. The one that has remained pretty much the stumbling block, I think, in black and white relationships is the housing problem. It still remains in housing. There are black areas and there are white areas. And in most cases, when blacks move in, whites move out. And the reasons for it are various. Some are economic, is the result of the fear on the part of white property owners that their properties would decrease in value. And in many cases, this fear is not unfounded, because what the pattern that had been happening was that the blacks move in, the blacks generally move in, those that move in are not all property owners. Those who move in are looking for places with more space, and what they, many of them, get into are houses that have been converted into many apartments, resulting in much greater crowding than ever happened before. And those houses that have been converted into apartments by absentee landlords and so on tend to become slums, and they do depress property values, and whites move out. The other is the fear of the unknown. There's quite a gulf between communication between blacks and whites. Different feelings about issues. Almost a different way of speaking. In other words, they've never lived together. And until they live together, they can't possibly, the full integration, I don't think, is really possible. Or trust, certainly blacks don't trust whites, because they've been You see, too often whites don't trust blacks because they fear violence. Until we were housing in this situation, until they really live together, integrated neighborhoods, you know, I don't think real integration is possible. Now, certain areas, but